What's up, boys? Welcome into the Mystery Crate. It's your boy, Anthony Calaudio. And as you know, on the Mystery Crate, we give you a plethora of options to indulge your earbuds with. What you're going to get this episode is something that is near and dear to my heart, something that I love to learn about, love to talk about, love to listen to, and that's hip hop. Who better to talk about hip hop than somebody who is co-hosting morning shows on undoubtedly the greatest hip hop station of all time on the planet? You can fact check that. You can, if you have an opinion on it, it's probably wrong, because Hot 97 in New York is the number one hip hop station. And Peter Rosenberg, who co-hosts Ebro in the morning, he's on the Michael K show. He does a lot of stuff with Complex. He's a guy that has his pulse on exactly what's going on in hip hop, and he has for the better part of two decades now. He's somebody that I've admired from afar and have always loved watching his work and listening to him and his opinions on hip hop and on the game and how everything is happening. So who better to have in this episode than Peter Rosenberg? Before we get to the hip hop conversation, I want to talk to him about COVID-19, about how it's affecting him, about how the media may change as we get out of the pandemic, a little bit of his journey on how he made it to Hot 97 and how he has all these amazing opportunities with the WWE Network, with Hot 97, with the Michael K Show on ESPN, like all these different things. He's a really fascinating character to me. Enjoy Peter Rosenberg and your boy Tony talking hip hop. Man, do I have a special treat for everybody, for all the listeners. Peter Rosenberg, you know him best from Ebro in the Mornings, from the Michael K Show. I mean, I could list maybe like 20 things that Peter does on a constant basis and revolving basis, but he's somebody that I admire just immensely from the ability for him to be in so many different fields and so many different industries at the same time and being so good at all of them. Peter, thanks for joining me and everybody on the Mystery Crate, bro. How are you doing during all this craziness, this pandemic? How's the family? How's everything?
Well, thank you. I appreciate the kind words. I'm cool. You know, I'm cool. I'm adjusting to this like everybody else is, and you know, phase by phase, learning what each phase sort of means. And you know, I think the experience of COVID-19 in New York is very different than every other experience in the country. And I think coming out of it's going to be different also. So it's just a matter of figuring kind of what you're comfortable with, where you stand, what changes you make. But you know, listen, I'm generally cool. So I don't have a lot of complaints. I've gotten to work, and a knock on wood, I've been, healthy and, you know, surviving. So I'm cool.
For us, the way that we do the show is we just get in through Zoom. And I know obviously you're doing multiple shows a day. How is that for you? Like, do you go out and travel? Are you guys, you know, deemed essential workers at the radio station, or are you doing stuff from home? Like, how does that look?
Yeah, I've been fully at home with the exception of all my radio shows have been home only. The only work I've done outside my home is for WWE. I've gone to Stamford twice to work from their studio on like a very small closed set with a handful of people. I did it for WrestleMania and I did it for the last pay-per-view Money in the Bank. Those are the only two times I've worked outside of my home.
An interesting point too is the way that media is going to change now in the future post COVID-19. How do you see things shaking out once we go back into a sense of new normal where, you know, the things that we would normally do are being done at like a super deconstructed level? Do you think that the future is doing stuff from home, or is it just going to be being more careful getting back into the studio? Like, how does that look?
I've been thinking about that a lot recently, like what the differences will be, what the pluses will be, what the minuses will be, because you do get the sense it'll be easier to say, hey, I'm working from home today. And people just to be like, okay, like we dealt with it every day for however long this is going to be. How much are you really going to freak out about one random day where you say you're working from home? Or, hey, I'm going away for a week. I'll be doing the show from there. I'm going to bring this and we're going to be fine. I think it's going to provide some major upside for those of us in the business in that way. I also think for booking guests, that will become a more acceptable thing, particularly in radio, to be like, hey, it's better than a phoner. it's not as good as in studio. Right. You know, it's right. It's in the middle, but you still get to connect with the person. And I think there'll end up being some downside from that too. Like people are like, oh, I'm not coming in anymore. Like when I do, I only want to do Zoom interviews and having to figure out how to make that work. So I think things will definitely be different. And again, it all depends on what happens here. Like we're in such mystery land about the next month or two. You know, I'm talking to people in some places and like, you know, you're in Florida, in California. It's basically like for a lot of people, they're just living life. Like right. It's already whatever. Whereas here, we're still very much like treating it like we're in the thick of it. So I don't think we know, like, is there going to be some huge resurgence where we all strictly lock down again and it gets crazy? Or are we just on our way to opening back up and everything's going to be okay and they'll find a vaccine and we'll move on? Like, it's just, there's absolutely no certainty at all. So I think a lot remains to be seen about how it'll affect our business.
For sure. And I think that there, like you said, there definitely are pluses to the fact that the game is going to change completely in the way that everything was so rigid before. I think we're going to start expanding to a more understanding places because of this COVID-19. But I'm just glad that we've been able to continue to do what we do, which is help people just kind of take their mind off of stuff. And I think that's one of the things that have been really like enlightening, at least for me and for us on the Levitard show, is the fact that the outpouring of people coming to us and saying on Twitter, hey, thank you for what you guys do. Like, you guys help us through all this stuff. Somebody was struggling with COVID or a family member and you guys got us through it just listening to you and making us laugh and stuff. So it, not that we're essential workers because we're not anywhere close to anything like that, but hearing that people appreciate what we do is kind of cool from that perspective.
Yeah, totally. And just the fact that we're like able, A, you realize how impactful it is, and B, you realize it's a field that like, man, we're lucky. Radio in particular, you can continue to do. Like, right. It's just basically, if we didn't get shut down through this, we're never going to get shut down. We're going to be, like, radio will be okay. It's funny because radio has taken so many bullets over the last decade of like, oh, radio sucks. Radio, everyone's listening to this. Everyone's listening to that, you know. And then here we are, you turn around. It's like, oh, radio's actually stood up pretty tough through this. And, you know, I have a lot of theories on radio and the way people treat it and, like, you know, how everyone's obsessed with podcasts but, like, has maligned radio.
Right.
And it's like podcasts is just – it's just fake radio. like, nah, man. No one's checking for radio. I do this other thing. It's like radio.
Like radio.
Like, you know, less people hear it, you know. And, like, it doesn't – it's not live. It doesn't have that sense of urgency. It doesn't feel important, you know. It's just like that, except, like, I can do it in my basement. And literally anyone can do it. Like, it's – so it's funny to me that – radio's taken so many shots for so long, and you realize now, like, all right, you know, radio might be all right.
So I want to go back in time. Take me to the first time that you realized, wait a second, I can do something in hip-hop radio. Like, where was that moment for you? Because I know you hosted a college underground hip-hop show back then. I know that you were doing just super interested in hip-hop from a young age, as was I. I just wasn't able to, I guess, use that into moving into a hip hop thing. I was moving it towards a sports thing. So when did you know, holy shit, I can actually do something in hip hop radio?
I really loved radio. I loved sports radio and I loved hip hop radio. And at some point I started getting like more passionate about the hip hop side than sports. It was around the time that Funk Flex started getting really big and we would come to New York to visit my grandparents. And even though I'd listened to the generation before that, Marley Marl, Red Alert, the early days hip hop radio stuff, and I love that too. Something about Flex and his bravado and like the showmanship of it all, I really, really liked and wanted to like emulate. And so I sort of started pretending to do that. And when I got to college to Maryland in 97, There were two simultaneous things. There was a big hip hop block on the radio station on Friday nights. And I had reached out to the dudes who did that block. I remember where I was when I wrote the email. I sent this email during my senior year of high school when I decided on Maryland. And I sent a blind email being like, hey, I'm Peter Rosenberg. I want to do this. I want that. And one of the dudes wrote me back, who's someone I consider a friend now to this day. And he basically was like, hey, write us an essay on why you should blah, blah, blah. And so it's funny. Now in retrospect, I get it a little bit more. And I sort of appreciate that they were like, this white dude wants to show up here and do this thing. Let's see if he's really about this. And in my classically white privileged way, I was like, I'm not writing a f***ing essay. Get out of here. And but to be honest, I totally view why you could argue two things. One could argue that was like total white privilege bullshit. There's also an element of hip hop to it too. That I was just like, I love this shit.
It's counterculture.
I love this shit. I know what I'm doing. I've been doing this. Like, I'm not writing you an essay or doing anything. I'm going to show up and do my shit. And so it all worked out great in the sense that I didn't write the essay, but I did show up every single week and just became the guy who was always there. And then they loved me and we became friends and they brought me in and they were called the Soul Controllers and they were a staple at Maryland. But like, we were a tiny, tiny station, a 10 watt radio station. We reached nobody. There was a lot of history in the station, but it was tiny. And so I was doing that, but simultaneously at Maryland, there were all these people doing sports and I was going to try to do sports broadcasting and do play by play and stuff as well. Honestly, when I got to the sports thing, the competition was so strong. Like, there were people I met who were so focused and so serious and they took sports in this way that was like so buttoned up. And I was like, I'm not doing this. I was like, this is not for me. Like, I don't know if I was scared off by the competition or just didn't like the energy of it, which by the way, kind of still how I am, you know, and like, my path to sports was totally roundabout as a result of that. So I just started really pursuing the hip hop side of it and then got an opportunity to intern at one of the hip hop stations in DC and interned for Tigger, who's, you know, a national personality.
I mean, yeah.
Who is, you know, like, he was legendary, but he was a local radio guy there and he went to Maryland. So I became his intern and just went incredibly hard as Tigger's intern. And, you know, I started figuring out like this could happen. Like, I could get a shot here one day. And I eventually did. I got overnights at PGC. I worked my way into PGC and, you know, I was definitively the only white dude doing that on both stations at that time in DC. And I started believing it then. They believed in me. I worked my ass off. Like, I was just a super ridiculous grinder. And then, you know, even when I was interning, Tigger he started doing a Friday night hip hop show. Like, I started pushing him back into hip hop harder.
Really?
Like, cause he was already, you know, Tigger was popping already.
Yeah, he was on BET. He was doing his own thing. He was almost on the TV side.
Right. So he was doing his radio show and it was cool. But yeah, he was the man. So I was like just such a hip hop nerd. That I think I helped a little bit kind of excite him too, because he is that at heart. He's a DJ. He's from the Bronx. Tigger's got an amazing history. He was a dancer in the video for Sally by Stetsasonic. Like, he's got real lineage in the game. And so, but he started putting me on Friday nights at 9 o'clock from 9 to 10. He would do, we'd have this 1 hour a week where we could play hip hop records, like real hip hop records. And he let me co-host it with him, basically. He was like, I would get to be like, he'd be like, what we play? And I would be like, we played this, we played that. And he would be like, PMD, that was my DJ name then. He was like, PMD's on the phones, and I would be the phone person. And I just got to do that. And, you know, it was in my hometown, too. So it was a huge, that was the beginning. So to answer your question as long as a way humanly possible, that, I guess, was when I started being like, I could do something here. Getting from there to Hot 97 still seemed impossible at the time, but that was the beginning of me thinking like, this is a path that could work.
So that's a really cool statement, because there's times in your professional career, and I'm saying just in anybody's professional career, where you set a goal or you think that if I make it here one day, like, that's it, I'm done. Like, I just achieved my dream. You know, that's why they always tell you, you know, aim a little bit higher when you're doing your goals, because once you get to a certain place that you think, I made it, you realize this ain't shit and I got to do more than what I'm doing. Like, for you, like, interning with Tigger, if you would have told yourself that a couple years prior, that would have blew your mind. And then a couple years later, you're at Hot 97. Like, when you walked into Hot 97 for the first time, not as an employee, as somebody just going to scope out the scene and what was happening, I draw the parallel very similar to me walking into ESPN or me walking into the Clevelander for Le Batard show. So I grew up listening to Le Batard as a 13-year-old kid. you know, fast forward 15 years later, here I am like walking in, being part of the show. So it's almost surreal, it's almost hollowed ground. So how was it when you walked into Hot 97 and looking at Funk Flex and looking at all these people, Ebro, and like saying, holy shit, I'm here. Like I made it here.
It happened in a couple of steps. So the first time I went up there, I didn't have a job, and I would call Hot 97 periodically and just try to get up the program director at the time on the phone. And eventually I got him on the phone and I kind of just gave him a spiel, and he was like, hey man, you know, you should come up here and let's take a meeting sometime. I was like 23, 24. And I just believed that like, I'm going to be the only white dude who like openly speaks his mind and knows what he's talking about and is credible and is not trying to be something else. I'm just going to be this guy. I know it can work. And I went up there and I met with this guy. His name is John Dimmick, and he was a white dude, radio guy, nice guy. And I was grateful he took the meeting with me. And I remember pulling up there in front of the building, like I couldn't even like fathom that I was walking inside. And like, you know, Hot, you know, listen, radio has changed, as we've said, but like at that time in the early 2000s, to be walking into that building, Hot, nothing's like it. Nothing in the world is like Hot 97. There are a lot of hip hop stations. Some have some equity, and then there's Hot 97. It's just a different thing altogether. So I was just like overwhelmed by it. And I met with him and he was kind of like, hey, you seem really passionate. I listen to your tapes. You sound pretty good, but like, you're not ready for this. And I don't know, you know, like this just isn't the time for you. Like you gotta go get better and, you know, earn your way, you know, like basically he just kind of gave me the opportunity to like taste it a little bit.
Right.
But was like, yeah, you're not ready for this. Yeah, not yet. And I was like, okay. So I went back and then kept a few years pass. And I end up hearing that Ebro, who had now become the program director, wanted to meet with me. So when I went back again, it was very strange. I walked into the building to their morning show, which was hosted by Miss Jones, who is a character, to say the least, and not someone in retrospect you would ever want to show up walking in on her show as a stranger. Like it's when people come into our show for some reason, like a friend of a friend was approved to come sit in, it's awkward even for them, and we're nice, and it's still like, no one really feels like dealing with that person at 6 a.m.
Right,
like,
right.
You just don't. Like, oh, your mom knows so-and-so and so-and-so, and now you're going to sit quietly in the corner when we want to be cursing between breaks and talking shit and, like, you know, and, like, and now we have to, like, kind of mind our mouths because you're here. Miss Jones did not f*** with me. She didn't even let me sit in the room during the show. I sat outside the room just listening to it in another studio. I actually fell asleep at one point. I was sitting there by myself. I knocked out, like, an hour. I was supposed to be sitting there, like – and I was just like, I didn't know what to do. And I was just like, Envy was really cool to me, but like Miss Jones didn't f*** with me at all. So the whole experience was mixed. I was kind of like, I don't even know what this is. And then like a week later, Ebro calls me and he's like, yo, bro, I got some good news and bad news. I was like, okay. He was like, the bad news is we're not going to use you as a producer on the morning show, because they've been considering for me to like come in and help write and come up with ideas, because I was doing YouTube content. So mm-hmm. They thought I could like help, you know, do that kind of shit. He was like, we're not going to go that direction. He was like, the good news is if you're up for it, I get excited every time I tell the story. I still get excited. He goes, the good news is if you're up for it, we were thinking about giving you like a Sunday night show where you can like play the new underground hip hop. And I was like, there's no bad news. That's good news and good news. Like, I don't want to work on that show at all. And having my own mix show is my fucking dream in life. And so that was it. I showed up there and the first event I ever worked was Summer Jam 2007. They wanted me to host the interviews and stuff. So they gave me a mic and my first day at work was just showing up to Summer Jam backstage with a camera and a mic and just interviewing people.
Give me the top five people you saw at that Summer Jam, and you were there like, holy shit, I'm talking to this person.
Oh, I mean, the video's up there. So like, you can find the video on YouTube, and it's ridiculous. I don't really know what I'm doing. But I was freaking for everybody. So, I mean, like, there was there was, I was freaking to meet Angie. Like I interviewed Angie.
Yeah.
And Miss Info, you know, so like I'm meeting Miss Info and Angie Martinez and I'm like, I'm your new coworker. Like it's ridiculous. The whole thing's ridiculous. I interviewed Ross and T.I. and I'm sure I saw the Lox and wow. Fab and just every, I mean, Summer Jam at that point still backstage was nuts, meaning like there were just tons of people everywhere. They've really locked it down. It's not quite the same anymore. At that point, it was still like when you're just standing in the hallway, you just see a mob of people walking in and then you're like, who's in the middle of that mob? Oh right. Shit, that's so and so. So it was just wild. And I was just, you know, going up to people and shooting my shot with each one and they didn't, no one was introducing me. I just had the mic flag and was like, hey, I'm so and so. It was amazing. It was amazing. And then I think that night was my first show on the air. So I got thrown right into it and it took a little while to really believe that I was on the air doing the show. It was pretty mind blowing.
You know, there's only a few people that don't have this affliction. And I feel like in radio, in media, a lot of us have this like innate insecurity about ourselves for some reason or another, right? We can go on and talk to, you know, like you do on Michael Kay's show where you talk to 18 million New Yorkers about whatever. Yet you go out and say, man, I sucked ass that segment. I was horrible that segment. And like we have this built-in insecurity about ourselves. When did you overcome that? Like being at Hot 97, doing your show, like meeting all these people and saying, everybody here is so much better than I am. Like, what am I doing here? How am I doing this? Like, how did you break through that?
So my insecurity manifests itself differently. I never have that part. I think I'm better than everyone. Like, I really do. When it comes to radio, I really think I'm as good as it gets. And until I, you know, with very, like, there are exceptions. Like, there are people I hear and I'm like, man, that person does stuff. That, like, there are people with certain skill sets that I don't have. Mm-hmm. And I will be like, wow, I can't do that. When we interview Bob Costas, the way Costas talks, his ability to have every word be meaningful, you're like, I just want to listen to you talk all day. I waste so many words. Like I blurt and ramble and I'm not there yet. Colin Cowherd, not a fan of him view wise at all. His ability to tease and keep people around, it's ridiculous. Like I'm a radio guy and he has gotten me to stay in my car and be yeah. like, I want to hear what this motherfucker says next.
I don't even
and
care like, what it is. I just want to hear it.
Yeah, like exactly. Charlemagne, I literally hate his guts as a human being and his ability to create a moment to be like, I'm going to make something happen here. And he sees it from before he does it. I don't know that it's something I would want to do, but I admire the ability to be able to do it. And I can't do it. So like, and I say, hate is strong. I don't like it. So I'm able to see certain things people do and be like, I don't have that skill. I would like to have that, or I don't think I'll ever have that. But my insecurity is like, it's more about acceptance. Like it's a really basic, like I said it to you over our text, like my insecurity comes out and I'm like, why has Levitard never had me on a show? That is, I'm literally the most outspoken in the entire company. Just like I'm fighting constantly the same sort of fights, but on the New York airwaves. And I'm like, and he loves people. He has random rappers who've had two songs on telling their stories. I'm like, do you know how many better stories I have in hip hop? Why have you not called me to be on your show? So it's more things like that. Like I'll see things within the company and I'll be like, I should get that opportunity. Why not me? Why does so-and-so get that spot? Not me. And I've, over the last 2 years, I've learned to see why that's faulty. And I'm not saying the feeling doesn't exist because it does, but I've really tried to get better at not feeling that insecurity and just being really happy with the work that I do. So yeah, for me, it's less about performance insecurity and more about acceptance, insecurity.
That's
but we all are insecure. I have never met one broadcaster who is not insecure. And so, I mean, like I said, Costas is the very rare example of he says he doesn't care what people say about him. He doesn't even look at it. He doesn't whatever. But for the most part, you know, from Michael Kay to Ebro to every big broadcaster I've ever been around, even though they're very confident in a lot of ways, I know all of their insecurities. I can see all of them. And I can certainly see mine very, very clearly.
And that's such an interesting point because, as you said, you see so many different people and they've attained such stardom in that field and yet are people that are insecure, are like you said, I think I'm the best, but why not this? Or they're like, I'm not that good. I don't even know why I'm here. Right. And then you think you're just like, you know, you've got 25 million downloads this year. What do you mean you're not good? So that part is really interesting to me, the psyche of the broadcaster, because somebody like you that dips their toes in both sports and hip hop has the avenue to see so much more, I think, than somebody that is, and by the way, in WWE too, like you do all these different things. How have you not spread yourself thin on this? Like, is it work ethic? Is it desire? Is it just like, I want to do this shit, so I'm going to fucking do it?
Well, I mean, I have spread myself thin in some ways. It depends. Like, life-wise, I haven't spread myself thin. I have at times. I'm currently very grounded everywhere. But, you know, I know this sounds really lofty, so forgive me. But, like, one person I relate to in terms of the job he has and how he gets crushed for it is Stephen A. Stephen A is the most, say what you want, he's the most compelling broadcaster we have in the company.
Or none. Bar none.
He's kept the lights on at certain points, right? Like, he's the man. However, he gets crushed for not being an expert kind of in anything anymore. NBA, I'd say he's pretty close to still being an expert, right? Yes. But still, he's not Woj. He's not Ryan Russillo. You know, but he's very high level. But the thing is, when you do as much work as Steven does, you can no longer be the in and out nerd of every detail. And guess what? That's not what makes him great. Right. What makes him great is his ability to entertain you when he's on a microphone. I suffer from the same thing in that I think I'm really good when I'm on the mic, but I'm no longer the foremost expert in hip hop. I'm not the foremost expert in sports, and I'm not the foremost expert in wrestling. So you end up getting all the things that you're passionate about and you live for. Every time you talk, there's someone who's like, you don't know shit, motherfucker. I know so much more than you. I had that job. I could do this, that, and this. And you just want to be like, yeah, but you don't have the job. And you're never going to fucking have the job because you're not as good and you don't work as hard. So I know I can no longer follow who every indie wrestler is in the world. I don't fucking know them until they get to WWE. That's just the way it is now. My job isn't that. My job now is to present it once it's here. I work the hardest on music, of course, because I'm so passionate about it. And my role is more important because on my Sunday night show, I can break artists and help careers. So I work a lot harder in the music area. But even there, dude, like, I know a lot of underground New York rappers, and if you were going to tell me, though, a bunch of new SoundCloud rappers who have 10 million, they could be huge. My niece and nephew are 12, and they put me on to stuff that I don't know, like in that SoundCloud mainstream world. So, like, you're just always going to have limitations, and I find that part to be challenging and frustrating, and at times you're like, I am spread too thin. Do I know anything about anything anymore? You know what I'm saying?
And it's funny too, because as you grow in the industry and as you grow, like you said, almost like you have to be a mile wide but an inch thick on, you need to know a ton of shit, but you're never going to be an expert in one thing unless you solely focus on that one thing. And I feel like I'm a kindred spirit with you in that sense, where I love sports, but that's not the only thing I want to do. Like, I love music, but I love something else. Like, there's so many different things on the spectrum that you can be a voice in. That's why I admire you so much, is because you have all these different places where you're on a different pedestal than everybody else because of the knowledge and because of the work you put in. And that's one of the things that I think I try to emulate in a bunch of different people that I see at that level, is everybody has the same thing, a fucking kick-ass work ethic. Like, that's it. Like, half the time, the people that I talk to is, I'm not better than the next guy. I just worked my ass off 10 times harder than he did. So when you talk about, and I think I'm going to bring this over to the hip hop scene. When you are trying to pick up on rappers and hip hop artists that you're going to bring up and be like, this is the next guy, I think he's there. What's that work ethic versus just God given talent? Like, how does that measure out?
I think, like, everything is split, because, like, I think that there are cats out there who were amazing and just never became much because they didn't put the work ethic in. Or in hip hop, to me, it's work ethic's always a mixed bag. They all work really hard, right? They're all like studio rats. There are a lot of people, though, who what they do in the studio is just sit around and get drunk. But for me, it's more about the, Are you willing to listen to what other people say? Are you willing to try to make complete songs versus just spit hot bars? Are you just trying to have a commercial sound right now? Or are you really an artist who's trying to push? So like in music, I think it's almost more complicated. There are multiple levels. There's like, there is the work ethic part. Like if you're not willing to grind, I know artists in my life who I really was passionate about. And I saw as time went on, I'm like, oh, they don't really want this like that. Like when the light started to shine, they were kind of like, I'm not trying to go on the road and do all this shit right now. Like I'm good. And the truth is your early run, it's really a grind. Like if someone says, hey, we want you to go do this event, we need you to be there. Then there are other people though. They're artists. We all know them at Hot. We could go through, I would never say their names out loud, but we all have artists at Hot who we know show up to everything we ever do, but they're not that great. You know, they show up, they're helpful. If we have a small event and we need a celebrity on it, they're like, no problem, radio station, I'm there. And you love artists like that, but some of those ones aren't that cool. They don't pop. They don't have the it factor. They're just kind of like hardworking good guys. So it can go both ways. Like you just sort of have to have a mix of really in music, really high level talent and really high level work ethic.
One guy that I feel is a really interesting case study from a hip hop perspective on how commercial he is, yet the mix between like his rhymes and his lyrics versus the way that he can sell himself, somebody you know very well, Action Bronson. Like Action to me is somebody that has crossed over. A lot of people have, but he's been able to cross over in ways of like, obviously his shows, like his books, the whole cooking aspect and food aspect of what he does on top of having like fire bars. He's somebody to me that is so interesting. Tell me like what makes Action Bronson work?
Well, Bronson decided at some point, I think after his album, I think he decided, I don't want to make like major label albums like this. And I'm just going to do what I do and I'm going to get money and popularity in the other things that I do. And the music part, I'm just going to fucking make hot shit that I feel, because I think he was frustrated by the process of Mr. Wonderful. Like I think it, I mean, listen, he's a complicated art. They're all complicated. Let's keep it real. They naturally all are. And I think him having to follow along, I mean, after that album, shortly thereafter, the management relationship he had with Paul Rosenberg ended, like he went his own way. I just think he decided being forced to be in that box just didn't work for him. Even though I think the album was great.
It was.
First of all. And I think that the song, the record with Chance should have been a smash. Absolutely. And had it come out 1 year later when Chance was a megastar, I think it would have been out of here. And I think there were a couple little things that could have made that song better. I think you could have put Chance's verse sooner. Like, I think there were a lot of little things that were just done that didn't allow for that to happen. I also thought that Acting Crazy could have been bigger.
Oh my God, and Acting Crazy is stupid. Like
I love
he has stuff.
Amazing.
He has stuff. He has analogies. He has just like wordplay that for me, when I listened to it, and it was all over Blue Chip 7000 too, like the stuff that he says and like just the way that he says it, you're like, holy shit, how does this guy even think of stuff like that? And that's what I mean when I say the work ethic versus the talent. I think that he has the talent just to be this like lyrically, this like mega star, yet he chooses to do something different, which is respect, because like you said, he had a problem with the label not trying to make these huge commercial hits. And then all of a sudden he comes out with Blue Chip 7000 and it's like, we've been doing a lot of these stupid challenges during the pandemic. It's like, what are the four albums you can listen to without skip? Blue Chip 7000 for me is one of those albums. I can listen from top to bottom and it just flows like a masterpiece.
Yeah. No, and that's the space he should be in. I mean, if he stumbles on a hit one day, which I think is possible, then he will. But he doesn't need to, because he gets his money other places. You know, Bronson's a master guest. He will always have a way to promote what he's doing because he's such a good guest on shows. Like, who doesn't want to talk to Bronson? He can literally do Martha Stewart or ESPN shows or hip hop shows. He can do anything and be engaging and awesome. So he'll always have that opportunity. But honestly, if 40 had gotten Drake on Acting Crazy, history is different.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when I heard Acting Crazy, I was like, they have to put Drake on the remix. This would be so high. It's actually one of my issues I have with Drake. I feel that Drake picks his spots where he wants to do things with people, but a lot of times there's a spot where he could change someone's career completely and he lays out. And to me, he should have been on Acting Crazy. That because it was a Drake record.
Yeah.
That is a Drake record that Bronson did. And it really, if Drake had popped in on verse two, oh my, it would have been.
It would have shut down everything. It would have shut down.
It would have been incredible. But it's still great. So I love that record.
We listen to stuff just as creatures of habit. Like I'll listen Acting Crazy a couple times a week just to hear it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And yeah. Blue Chip 7000, I'll pick different, the Bonsai, different tracks where I'm just like, I need to hear it. You know, Choreographer, all of those. Getting to Drake really quick. Why is it? And I don't know if you have the answer here. Why is it that everything he touches is gold? Everything.
In some ways, it's just obvious because he's great and he's catchy and his songs are just good. And then there's another level to it that's like hard to even quite figure out. Although I will say it's very interesting to gauge whether his current record is a hit.
Mm.
You know, he hasn't had a miss. No one's had a record like Drake. Like that's just his record of success is, I'm not saying in terms of quality. We can argue quality all day. I still argue that Drake is still missing a quote unquote classic album.
Mm.
And I know there are other people who feel that Take Care is a classic and I'm too old for it. Maybe so. Not a classic to me.
It's right there. But it's close.
Either way, the success, it's inarguable. No one's had a run like this on top. Certainly in hip hop, I might argue no one's had a run like this on top, period, in any genre. I'd have to go look. I'd have to go open up the Beatles catalog and look at the years to see, because your gut goes, well, the Beatles, sure. But the Beatles are completely over by the mid-70s. So I'd be curious to look on the timeline and even see what the Beatles or like, you know, Stevie's run on top. Like, yes, he was little Stevie Wonder. But then his real run as like a credible adult artist, you're talking about from the mid, late 60s to the early 80s. Like it's always now Michael Jackson's run. If you include the Jackson 5, that's an unbelievably, I mean, Michael had success over 40 years, which is just f-ing incredible. But Drake is in a conversation with artists like that. Like the fact that I had to go, let me look at the Beatles, Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson. The fact that you have to go there to make comparisons, because you can't do it in hip hop. While people's runs have been as long, none have been as consistent. You know, Hove has had an incredibly long run. He was never as consistently dominating the hip hop sound as Drake was. He would go in and out and go away for a few years and come back. And Drake now, since he came out, you're talking about a full decade, 10 straight years of number one.
Insane.
10 straight. So now listen, I guess I'm exaggerating. For him to get to the true level of the guys we just mentioned, he'd have to do it for another 5 or 6 years before you could really say that. But the thing is, I don't have any evidence he's ever going to brick. So until I see it, and that's why I said this most recent album's interesting to gauge, because like you would think 2C Slide would be the biggest record in the world. It doesn't feel like it is, but no one's partying really. So I can't quite tell what its success level is.
Right. And now he's talking about coming up with another studio album coming up this summer. So are we going to see something there that could be that next, the pinnacle that he's trying to reach of like a masterful album? Because when you look across,
he needs that.
He has to. And when you look across like his peers, when you talk about greatness, like there's guys that have made masterful albums. Like for me, Kanye West is My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. I think to me is his magnum opus. Like I don't know if there's another record that just top to bottom is as perfect as that one. Yet when you look at Drake, you say, okay, Take Care. Maybe Nothing Was the Same. Okay. Scorpion was kind of a throwaway. He just doesn't have that yet.
Kanye, you can argue he has three just absolute masterpieces, right? Like My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy is my favorite one, I think. But I could be in a mood and argue Graduation is like right there in the same breath. Even 808s is incredible. And you're like at the time, we're like, what is this? And then now you look back and you go, oh my God, almost every song.
It was
awesome.
Everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Yeezus is not perfect, but parts of it are awesome. And then Life of Pablo is ridiculous. Like it's now its best moments are just ridiculous. Like it has a stretch where you're like, this is perfect. Then his most recent records in a period when I straight up don't like him, don't want to hear from him, don't find you interesting, think you're stupid at this point and don't make sense. Shut the fuck up. I still love the records. Like, I still think they're good. Like, I still think Ye has a bunch of great shit on it. And even the last record, while I find his rapping to be trite and stupid, musically on the gospel incredible. Record, there are a handful of songs that are beautiful and incredible. So, like, he has put himself in a category that's incredibly challenging. And if he didn't shoot himself in the foot so bad, like, he is damaging his legacy long term. There is no doubt in my mind that we will, if he doesn't turn it around at some point, we will not talk about him in quite the same terms as we should be.
But that's crazy.
Drake doesn't have a beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. That, no. He has a lot. He doesn't have that.
He doesn't. And just to touch really quick on that Jesus is King, like, the gospel sounds, and it goes to show you just how much of a musical genius Kanye is, where he can take those samples and take basically a choir and just have them do that and sound the way, like, sonically, I think that album is beautiful. If you listen to the music, like the old Southern gospel choirs, like, all of that stuff is just incredible to me to see. And it is true. Like, he's got so many just like hits on albums that even when he misses, it still sounds good. And I think that's
the question
really
for Kanye. The story ultimately gets written on Kanye like this, which is, what does he actually do on those records?
Mm.
I think it's all up for major debate. And I think one day we will need to dig in. And by the way, we wouldn't have done this if he wasn't an asshole. Mm. But since you are being an asshole, now you're going to make me really question, have you been doing it, or are these Mike Dean albums?
Ooh.
Because a lot of people feel that Kanye, over the last decade or so, goes into album mode, steals from the other talented people around them, takes their sounds, whether it's Drake, whether it's Chance, whether it's Big Sean, whether it's Kid Cudi, whether it's Mike Dean, sucks all the creative juice out of them, takes that juice and adds it to what he does, and all of a sudden gets magic. And like I said, I don't think people would question it, but now his other decisions make you question his moral fabric. And now that I'm questioning your moral fabric,
now we can
I'm
start questioning, digging.
Are you ripping people off too? Because once I saw you go up to the White House and do everything you did and say all the dumb shit you've said repeatedly, now I'm like, do you just not give a shit? Like, are you really just like the same as the Kardashian social media, and it's all just sort of to get play? And now I got to question it all. And like, I don't know that I would go back and question the first couple albums, but let's be real. The first couple albums, as great as they are, they have a lot more filler than the later stuff.
Oh, like, absolutely.
It gets much better as he gets older. And when Mike Dean comes around, it really changes. Good.
Right.
So it's all in question and an interesting conversation to have. I'm sorry to be hard on Kanye.
No. It's all good, dude. We'll let you go on this, dude. Thank you again for joining us on the Mystery Crate. COVID-19, when you think of the way that music has changed, where the money is not in the albums, the money is not in streaming, the money is on tours, the money is going to concerts, the money is gathering people to listen to your stuff. Now that we're in this age of social distancing, of the new normal of we can't congregate, and all these different things going into the future until a vaccine's found, and even then, who knows what's going to happen, as we see in sports too. How is the future of hip-hop going to be made now that concerts are going to be maybe obsolete? Like, how does that work?
I actually think the biggest example we got was the Bounty Killer Beanie Man versus, you know, as for people who don't know, these battles have been happening with Swizz and Timbaland. And up till now, up till this weekend, to me, I was like, I love them, but I didn't see a model that made sense. But with Beanie and Bounty in the same room with the sound perfect,
yeah,
where they were running the sound properly, I was like, oh, people would pay for this shit.
Mm-hmm.
People would pay for this shit. They had 400 some thousand people in that room. If they were charging $19.99, they would not have had 400,000 people in that room, but they would have had 50,000 people in that room. And that's a shitload of money. Like,
absolutely.
So I think we will see the cross-pollination between social media and live performances coming together.
Wow.
And concerts are things that you have small parties at home to watch on television.
Wow.
And I think there'll be a shitload of money in it. And frankly, I would enjoy it more than going to a concert.
For sure.
Like, I would love having a party with 15 people and we know the time and everyone has drinks and you plug in your stereo system and it's like intimate and looks awesome. And I'm not saying it would satisfy the exact same thing and I'd be happy with it forever, but for a run for a couple years, yeah, I think it would work.
That's crazy. That's, and it goes to show you, like, the sound quality needs to be right, because I remember with RZA and Primo, it was like, RZA couldn't get his sound right, and it just didn't, like, it didn't flow as naturally as it could. And then Beanie and Bounty was like, oh shit, like, this is incredible.
And by the way, the main thing it took was them being in the same room, because there are pretty simple setups that you can buy to make your shit sound flawless. It's not that hard. It's basically right. One box that you run into and then run out of and plug it in and shit sounds good. So the fact that they were together made it very easy, and they had two DJs there who were able to set it up properly. Though every battle, I wonder, I'm like, where's your DJ friend who's just like, let me help?
Who's hooking you up, man?
Like, I would have, if I was there at any of them, I would have been like, guys, this is, trust me, whenever I have my own stupid little lives in my DJ room, I'll probably have one in a little bit today. All I do is put my phone near the speaker. It sounds great. Like, you don't need to do that much.
It's not complicated.
No, very strange.
Oh, man. He's Peter Rosenberg. Again, catch him on Ebro in the Morning. Catch him on the Michael Kay Show. Catch him on Cheap Heat, WWE Network. Juan Epstein, whenever you guys get around to doing that. Just everywhere. Open late.
Thank you, man.
What else do we have? Real
Late on Sunday nights? Yeah, you're hitting a lot. If you want to listen to the Sunday night show, I've been uploading them recently on my Mixcloud page, Rosenberg Radio. So if you want to hear the new underground shit that I'm playing, you can catch that on my Mixcloud. I post a lot of it. I'll repost the artists and stuff on my Instagram stories at Rosenberg Radio as well. But thanks for making time, dude. It was a fun conversation.
Dude, absolutely. Appreciate you making time too, man.
Cheers.
A huge shout out and thanks to Peter Rosenberg for hooking it up and talking with your boy. I think that was a really interesting look into his journey, into what's going on in hip hop right now. And again, this is a menu item. We've got a lot of them here on the Levitard and Friends Network. One that I do want to pitch right now is South Beach Sessions. Dan does an incredible job with some of the most influential and smart and interesting people that he has come through the studios in South Beach. And go listen, subscribe, rate, review to all of the South Beach Sessions. The one with Bob Costas was a two-parter. And I don't know if there's somebody more trained, more polished than Bob Costas, and where he never wastes a word. And in the interview that you just heard, obviously we make reference to Bob Costas being somebody who just does not use filler words, which is incredible. Obviously took a long time to get that way, but those are the last two recent episodes of South Beach Sessions. And again, you can listen to any of the shows on the Levitard and Friends Network, whether it be Stupidity, South Beach Sessions, Marty Smith's America, That's What She Said with Sarah Spain, the Mina Kime Show featuring Lenny. All of those are great listens. Thank you for supporting us during this difficult time. Again, we give you the menu options so you can have your flavor and taste of whatever it may be. Make sure to continue to rate, subscribe, review to all the pods on the network. And until next week, peace.